So I was working on this series on the Four Noble Truths the past times that I was here. The last time I talked about the second noble truth, and the time before that about the first noble truth. And just as a refresher, the first noble truth is there's suffering, or dukkha in Pali. And then the second noble truth is there's a cause for suffering, which is craving. And the third noble truth, which is there is the end of suffering, awakening. And then the fourth noble truth is that there is a path leading to the end of suffering, the Noble Eightfold Path. So I'm supposed to talk about the third noble truth today, but I'll be talking more about the fourth noble truth. Because I think that's a little more practical than the third one. So maybe and since I'm leaving to go to the Netherlands for a month, I thought I'll just do the fourth noble truth first, and then maybe when I come back and back I'll get to this third noble truth. But just very briefly, the third noble truth is basically the end of the Buddhist path, which is awakening. So when we're fully awakened, then there's no suffering anymore, or dukkha. Suffering is not the best translation, as I explained during that first talk. And so when we apply the fourth noble truth, the path leading to awakening, the Eightfold Path that we're talking about today, then we'll arrive at some point at this goal. And the Buddhist teachings, this can take many lifetimes, even if you know don't believe in that kind of thing. It's just funny to, or interesting maybe to know that it might take us a few lifetimes to get there. So don't be disappointed if you don't get there tonight. Yeah, so there's a lot of interesting stuff to say about this end goal, but we'll leave that for another time. Yeah, so let's look at this path that leads to the end of suffering, the Noble Eightfold Path. And like I said, suffering is not the best translation. It's more about like unsatisfactoriness. And it's also the case that what we're actually doing with when we walk this path that contains of these eight steps is that we're reducing our suffering or our unsatisfactoriness in life bit by bit by bit. It's more like a gradual path that develops and leads to more and more happiness and less suffering and unsatisfactoriness if we actually walk this path. And like I said in the other two talks, there's this sutta where the Buddha describes each of the noble four noble truths. So about the fourth noble truth, the Buddha says the following. This is the noble truth of the practice that leads to the cessation of suffering. It is simply this Noble Eightfold Path. That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So that's what the Buddha has to say about it. And here and there in the suttas, he goes more into more depth about each of those factors. But in the main sutta where he's setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, where he explains the Four Noble Truths, he doesn't explain those in depth. And first, I want to look at the Pali translation of the words right, of the word right, because it in this translation that I'm using, it says right view, right intention, etc. But right can really like have this connotation. This thing's not working really well, but this connotation of that it can also be wrong, right? So it's not so helpful for most of us to think of it as right. So often, teachers offer another kind of translation of this word, which is samma. The word sama in Pali can also mean wise or skillful. So that might be a bit more helpful to think about it like that. And so this Eightfold Path can be divided into three sections or groupings. As you can also see on the sheet, the first two steps, wise view and wise intention together form the wisdom section of the path. And then wise speech, action, and livelihood form the ethics or sila section. And then wise effort, mindfulness, and concentration are the cultivation or meditation section. And so tonight will be kind of an overview of the path. I can't go into much depth on each factor, of course, because we don't have that much time. I could probably give a talk on each of these. And if I wouldn't go, I've gone to the, or have plans for the Netherlands, maybe I would have given like three talks on the Eightfold Path. But I thought I'll just give an overview now. So wise view is the first. And this is maybe because it's kind of interwoven with every other path factor. So it's not that we kind of necessarily walk this path in sequential order. So we first have to nail down this wise view thing and then we can go on to wise intention. No, it's more like we're developing each factor at the same time and they're all kind of strengthening each other and interweave with each other. If we work on one path factor, it actually also influences the other ones. But we do need some wise view in every of those path factors. It's kind of a foundational path factor. I'm not sure who said it, but kind of like wise view is starting us off on the path and it's also ending us on the path. So if we, the ultimate wise view is the wise view that is liberating, that fully liberates us. And so there are two types of wise view. The first one is mundane wise view, and then the second one is supramundane wise view. And mundane wise view is about understanding what leads to wholesomeness and what leads away from wholesomeness, towards unwholesomeness. And then the supramundane wise view is about seeing dukkha, so the suffering, the unsatisfactoriness, and the end of dukkha clearly. So this means seeing the Four Noble Truths clearly. So I can circle around back to the Four Noble Truths. So understanding the Four Noble Truths on a deeper level is having a wise view on the supramundane level. And so there is, I find very interesting that Joseph Goldstein is one of our founding fathers of this, in this country, of this tradition. He has in his book called Mindfulness, he refers to this mundane right view, so the right view that is about wholesome and unwholesome. This mundane right view can give us this worldly ease. So it's really about getting more and more easeful in our lives, more and more wholesome. And this is already something quite amazing that we can do with this path, gaining this worldly ease, basically. And that's often also why we come to meditation. We are looking for some ease in our lives, less suffering, less dukkha. And so let's move on to wise intention. So that's also an important one. They're all important, I guess. But intentions lead to thoughts, lead to action. So paying attention to our intentions can be really helpful and skillful. So it's also kind of like if we look at the teaching on karma, then it's in intention that makes karma wholesome or unwholesome. And it's not so much what you do, but more what the intention is behind what you're doing that creates wholesomeness or unwholesomeness in your life. So if you step on an ant and you didn't know, then you didn't have an intention to kill the ant. So then it's not unwholesome karma. But if you are frustrated by ants running to your kitchen and you kill them, then it's unwholesome karma because it's your intention to kill them. And the Buddha describes wise intention as three specific wholesome intentions. He says, and what practitioners is wise intention? Intention of renunciation, intention of non-ill will, and intention of harmlessness. This is called wise intention.
Can you repeat that, please?
Yeah, so there's, I'll go over it. There's three wise intentions. The first one is the intention of renunciation. And, you know, we can phrase this a little differently. It's about letting go, not clinging, not desiring. And then the intention of non-ill will. Phrased differently, it could be the intention of goodwill, intention of kindness. Intention of harmlessness. Phrased differently, could be the intention of compassion. So we have letting go, goodwill, and compassion as our wholesome intentions. And we can look at our own experience. Is what I'm doing coming from an intention of goodwill and kindness and letting go? Or is there clinging in my intention or some frustration or even hatred, ill will? Am I trying to harm? Is there an intention of harm? So that's a really good one to look at in our experience. So these were the two aspects of the wisdom section, wise view and wise intention. Moving on to the sila or ethics section, starting with wise speech. And the Buddha says, what bhikkhus is right speech or wise speech? Abstinence from false speech, abstinence from divisive speech, abstinence from harsh speech, and abstinence from idle chatter. This is called wise speech. So this is kind of in terms of abstaining, like abstinence of this and that. And no false speech, no divisive speech, no harsh speech, no idle chatter. And sometimes the Buddha also phrases it differently in the suttas, then he says it in more positive framing. Which is in different suttas, so this is more the sutta on the path, and then in different suttas he says, for example, what five things should practitioners establish in themselves? First, I will speak at the right time. I will speak truthfully. I will speak gently. I will speak beneficially. And I will speak lovingly. So that might be more helpful for some people to phrase it in that way, like checking sometimes, like, is this the right time? Is this truthful? Is this gentle and beneficial and loving? Or sometimes also translated as just kind. Is this kind? So those are some ways to work with wise speech. And a while ago I gave a whole morning on wise speech, which was really wonderful, and some of you were there. It's really a very rich practice to practice wise speech. We talk so much during our lives, even if it's like through email or social media, but also at our work or school or with family and friends, and really paying attention to, again, the intention behind the words. So wise intention is really important here. It's this intention of kindness, an intention of gentleness, timeliness, truthfulness. And as you might start to see here, that the basic underpinnings of this whole path is about wholesome and unwholesome. Like, is our speech wholesome or unwholesome could be a very easy way to look at speech and not have to remember all those different aspects of it. But is it wholesome or unwholesome? Is there a wholesome or unwholesome intention behind it? Wise view and wise intention are all about wholesomeness and unwholesomeness. And as we see, the rest of the path also has this underpinning of wholesome versus unwholesome. And wise action. The Buddha. And what practitioners is a wise action? Abstinence from the destruction of life. Abstinence from what taking what is not given. Abstinence from sexual misconduct. That is called wise action. So some of you might I can't find the word. Some of you might recognize the five precepts here. Five precepts for lay practitioners, or some of them. And in addition to not killing, stealing and harming others with our sexual energy. And so the five precepts also mention, beside those things, not lying and not using substance that could cloud the mind. And the not lying part is covered with the wise speech, right? And so this is also really about Buddha encouraging us to engage in wholesome behavior that is based on wholesome intentions. And the intention to not kill and to be kind to all beings. The intention to not steal, but to be generous. Intention to not harm with sexual misconduct, but to care about other beings. And then on to wise livelihood. And then there's also a description of wise livelihood, where the Buddha says, what is wise livelihood? This is when a disciple of the noble ones, which is us, having abandoned dishonest livelihood, keeps his life going with right livelihood, or wise livelihood. This is called wise livelihood. So it doesn't tell us much. but luckily, in other suttas, he does tell us a little more about what he means. So there's this other famous sutta where he lists five occupations that are not so great to get involved with, which are, I'll read the sutta quote. He says, a lay follower should not engage in these five trades. Trades in weapons, living creatures, meat, intoxicants, and poisons. A lay follower should not engage in these five trades. Weapons, living creatures, meat, intoxicants, and poisons. So that gives us a bit more information. not to engage in, again, unwholesomeness. Like, all these things can contribute to harm. And so that's, again, like, is there an unwholesomeness intention behind our job, or is there wholesomeness present? And of course, it will always be kind of a mixture. You know, this can go really nuanced. But, like, we can look at the kind of the main tendency of what our livelihood is like. And sometimes you can also even look at just your whole life. Is there wholesomeness, a wholesome tendency or an unwholesome tendency also when you just engage in your life or do volunteer work or, you know, all these kind of things. And so this was the section on ethics, sila in Nepali. Wise speech, action, and livelihood. And so to engage skillfully with these three aspects of sila, we actually need right view, wise view. We need to discern what is wholesome and unwholesome. We also need the wise intention, like intention comes first and then the actions into the world. And then we need the wise mindfulness that we'll look at in a little bit. Like, you know, we need to be mindful of what is actually happening, right? and so let's move on to the cultivation meditation section. The first is wise effort. And I won't read the quote for wise effort because that's going to take too long. It's a very flowery, long quote. So I'll just give the summary. The Buddha says that the wise effort is about four things. There's four great efforts, as they're named. The first one is making an effort so that unwholesome states that have not yet arisen won't arise. That's the first one. The second one is making an effort so that unwholesome states that have arisen will be abandoned. And then the third one is making an effort so that wholesome states that have not yet arisen will arise. And then the fourth one is making an effort so that wholesome states that have arisen will stay and increase. So here we see the wholesome unwholesome again. Trying to diminish the unwholesome and let the wholesome grow and arise. And I, when I first started meditating, I had this kind of, through the teachings that I received, I kind of got this idea that I was only supposed to be passively kind of experiencing everything and not do anything, like passive. But then I learned about this teaching on the four great efforts. And I realized, oh, we're supposed to be a little bit more active maybe than what we usually hear. And I thought that was pretty liberating for me, like, oh, I am actually allowed to do something. So there are several ways that we can go about each of these. And unfortunately, I don't have like too much time to go into those today, but it might be a really interesting topic to discuss maybe another time. Maybe I can give a talk on it. And we talked about this a little bit with the Sutta study for those who were there, and where we are replacing unwholesome thoughts with wholesome ones, for example. One way to do it is to do metta, loving kindness meditation, like that really generates wholesomeness. So that's one of the big ones we can use to work with this effort, great effort of wholesomeness. So then wise mindfulness is the next step on the Eightfold Path. And here the Buddha, this is also a pretty long quote. The Buddha talks about wise mindfulness being contemplating the body, contemplating feelings, contemplating the mind, and contemplating phenomena or dhammas. So these are the four establishments or the four foundations of mindfulness. That's basically wise mindfulness. So you've all been listening to the Sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Gill, Franz Dahl, in the weeks I'm not here. So you're all pretty familiar with them, I guess, the four foundations of mindfulness. Body, feeling, tone, mind, and mind objects or phenomena, as they're translated here. So yeah, that's basically what we're doing usually, right? We're being aware of those aspects in our experience. That's what wise mindfulness is. One of the things that mindfulness does for us is that we become aware of all the other factors, basically. What leads to wholesomeness, what leads away from wholesomeness. Is wise view present or not? Is wise intention present? What is my intention here with this action or this speech, etc. We really need mindfulness during this whole path to support the path, else we don't know what's happening. So mindfulness helps us to know what's happening. And then wise concentration. Here the Buddha says that one is secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. A bhikkhu, or a practitioner, enters and dwells in the first jhana, enters and dwells in the second jhana, enters and dwells in the third jhana, and enters and dwells in the fourth jhana. This is wise concentration. So the Buddha is really clear here that wise concentration is practice of jhana. And jhanas are these absorption states, very deep concentration states. And there's quite a bit of debate going on in the whole Vipassana insight scene, where some teachers say, yeah, you do need jhana to progress on the path, at least to attain liberation, not for the worldly ease, but to attain liberation. And others say, no, you don't. And I know that, for example, Mahasi Sayadaw, who is basically the teacher of, for example, Joseph Goldstein, So this is Burmese monk who passed away last century. And he, in his monastery, would only teach Vipassana, only insight meditation and not jhana, until people had reached the first stage of awakening. There are four stages. And until they had reached the first stage, he would not let them let them practice jhana. And so only when, so that kind of gives us a clue of that we can at least attain the first stage of awakening. And then it might be easier also to attain jhana, to get into jhana. Because it's, you know, it does ask a lot from us, or some people have a natural ability to go into jhana, and for some it takes a little while. It can take weeks or months of deep intensive meditation practice to get there, so it's kind of a high bar for a lot of people. And so it's good to know that, you know, that Vipassana is very powerful in itself, and it does lead to a certain amount of concentration, just not the absorption concentration, the jhana concentration. But it's always so that mindfulness and concentration will kind of work together. If we are doing just concentration, we'll need some mindfulness, because else we don't know what's happening. For just doing mindfulness, we'll need some concentration will come in, because else our mind will just be scattered, and you know that doesn't work either. So that was the section on cultivation / meditation, the wise effort, mindfulness and concentration. And then together that forms the whole Eightfold Path overview. and so this path, it really asks for engagement in all the aspects of our life. It's not just, you know, sitting on our cushion for half an hour a day. This is really like a whole life path, which is also the title of Gregory Kramer's book about it, which is also very accessible. It's very thick, but it's very accessible, well-written book about the Noble Eightfold Path. It's like something that we can implement in our whole life, in every aspect. And so let me end with a quote from the Buddha, from the Dhammapada. Of all paths, the Noble Eightfold Path is the best. Of all truths, the Four Noble Truths are the best. Of all things, the passionless state, Nibbana or awakening, is the best. By following the Noble Eightfold Path, you can put an end to suffering. You yourself must make a strong effort to attain Nibbana, awakening. Buddhas only point the way. Those who follow the path and those who meditate will be freed from Mara's bonds. Mara meaning delusion and ignorance, the personification of that.